Good evening, everyone. It's 2 weeks went by. Yeah. So today's topic is foundation for trustful surrender, something like that,
right?
Cultivating love for divine. Cultivating love for divine. Good. Most important thing is here to understand our basic human nature and looking at whether or not we need something more than whatever so far we have in terms of our own understanding of ourselves and others. Everything in the world is, as we have reached in our state of evolution, everything is an object that can be consumed, that can be acquired, that can be consumed. That's what puts a value on something, whether it's valuable or not so valuable. Price tag. Everywhere in the world, there is a price tag on everything. And that's how we evaluate. That's how we measure the size and the shape and the quantity and quality of everything. When, let's say, earthquake comes, or big flood comes, then we measure it, that how many million dollars or how many billion dollars damage has taken place. And incidentally, we also mention there how many people died. That is very late, you know. 1,000 people died, but $20 billion damage. So the 20, let's say 1,000 people's value is $2 billion. Everything that is lost, including their life, is $2 billion. This concept keeps getting stronger, 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 more. What to call? Crystallized. As it does, our mind becomes more and more outward oriented, less and less, you know, inward oriented. More and more we become, quote, materialistic. People have different definitions of materialism. Normally it is believed to be, materialism means, you know, or believed to be, that a philosophy or a lifestyle that believes in lots of money. It's a little bit more than that. You know? It's a little bit more than that. It is something out there and how we perceive it. And it is very important to understand, only then we can get to the idea of, quote, God. Otherwise, God is not much different from what we already know about life. No? It's an idea. God is an idea. God is even a reality. If God is here, right here, we'll always look for how to make money out of him. Whatever is the most valuable thing out there, we'll always look for God as a means to achieve it. If God is not useful, then God is not meaningfully useful to achieve that. Then God is as useless as dirty, ugly looking disposable newspaper of old newspapers. So this is how we are, let's say, perceiving about life, that what is there that I'm looking for? There is sutra in the Yoga Sutra. That is, drashtri drishya sanyogo hiya hetuhu. Union of the one that is seeing in us, the union of seer and the seeable, the union of perceiver and perceived, is cause of sorrow. Now, it is such a terse thing. What do you mean? I'm a seer from my standpoint. And if I'm seeing you, then you are seeable. The union of mine and yours is cause of misery. And the freedom from this misery lies, the freedom from the misery lies in our separation. How many of you get it? Do you understand any of it? What does it really mean? I see you, I'm as a seer, and you are as seen, you are seen by me. This seer and the seeing together, I just saw you and I'm miserable. Or because I saw you, you are miserable. I see you and you see me, therefore both of us are miserable. What is this crazy philosopher called Patanjali trying to tell us? If I do not see stars, if I do not see the sun and moon, do you think I will be less miserable just because I didn't see the sun and moon? And yet it is said to be the cause of misery in life. What is happening here is we are seeing things through our own lens. And we are trying to avoid seeing things on the ground of what we have decided to not to see. We are seeing things what we have decided to see. And we are trying to avoid seeing what we have decided not to see. Why is that? So, this is what actually the cause of sorrow. Value is always called, quote, perceived value. Perceived value. When you look at so many things happening out there, let's say, I don't know whether this company called Amazon has started making money or do not, I do not know. But you know how valuable is Amazon? Madarsa, do you think that there is revenue stream, actual revenue now coming in Amazon, which is called net profit? In our small little world, you are running, let's say, a cafe. No? And on a daily basis, you have certain expense, and in proportion to that expense, you see how much money is coming, and how much, after deducting the expenses, how much is left. That's called net profit. So Madarsa, are you aware of anything is happening with Amazon? Has Amazon started making money? But the stock keeps going up, everybody's very happy, trading is already happening, people invest money in Amazon. Amazon is just one example I gave you. But for a long time, nothing was happening in it. The Amazon's value was going up, 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 up. People were looking forward for certain things. There was hope that one day this thing will happen, that thing will happen, that thing will happen. And also, lately I'm learning about stating your value proposition. These are terminologies Madalsa's daughter is teaching me. Or at least by reading what she writes, I learned those terms. Value proposition, for example. So one of the things you must do when you are telling about the grandeur of your project or your company, that you delineate as many risks as possible. And it is in the light of those risks, then you delineate your reasons why your project is so great. So you are contrasting, you are putting the both things, your strengths and weaknesses side by side. But however, do it in a manner that people are able to see what you want them to see. And what, no, it's very important. So there is a list of 20 great reasons why this is an excellent project. And probably there are 20 great reasons why this project might flop. And then delineate these both things in right context and right manner. And here is the value of your company, value of your product. For last 10 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, you did not have any evidence, you don't have any evidence that in the last 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, you really succeeded. And yet, just because you did not fail, your ground is that you are going to succeed. You believe in it. And you believe in it so strongly that others' minds are also forced to believe it. There is a term called investor confidence. And this is happening in every aspect of life. All of us have invested so much in our body, mind, senses, consciousness, our belief system, that we have no room left to return anymore. We must continue on that same very path. It's an enormous investment that has gone into, and this is, into our life and lives. And therefore, we are on this path. Continue on this path, and then it will be harder for you to look back and see whether there are any other possibilities. And this is going on for ages. Now, in this process, just to imagine what has happened to us. We do so many things in life and we don't think that it is that harmful to us. Drug, gun, and list can go on. And yet, prayer is somewhat we are very suspicious about. Why? Yoga has something to do with mind. And it has a gesture of humility in it. It talks about devotion, talks about love. And has and yoga comes from or is associated with a particular faith, community, or even just a time period that is not similar to the time period and the values of ours. Therefore, the resistance. So there is all kinds of, you know, anti-yoga movement in the school system. Or there are lots of things in super top priority. Let's say India, for example, they can be in super top priority. Women being abused, raped in daylight. That seems to be a very urgent thing to take care of. 45% children of the entire, you know, of India, which is half the children of the entire planet, they are malnourished, undernourished. That seems to be a very urgent thing to take care of. Okay? Women, they are dragged into beggary, prostitution, and many, many other forms of slavery. They are called Devdasis. It's custom, which is disgrace to any society. That seems to be a very important thing to take care of. These are urgent issues in life. And yet, that is not in the priority list. What is in the priority list? Let us burn, vandalize a church. It's almost daily news in Delhi, Agra, this is happening. Let's say, if we can postpone uprooting Christianity for next 20 years, if Christ can still continue to exist in India, if his statues, you know, or if Mother Mary's statues, still continue to exist, if we do not demolish a church, you know, almost 90-100 year old church in Agra, if we do not demolish that church for next 20 years, and as a result, if we save our time and energy and money to take care of even 5-10 kids and send them to school, which one will you prefer? Just let's say, if really it is something very, very urgent issue for a Hindu-dominated country called India, if it is very urgent to just immediately, just to take care of, just to remove the Christianity from the country, this is one issue. And there are, you know, many, many these other issues. Upgrade, you know, the system of your school and college and have some nice, nice books, you know, your libraries, you know, there are hardly any books left, you know, there are more rats in the libraries than the books, you know. Now, you go into the library, you know, in majority of the libraries in India, so much, and dust is so old that you start sneezing, and if you stay there for more than 5 minutes, you will come back with, you know, sneezing and, you know, some allergies will be there. A person like me cannot enter majority of the libraries in India because of the, you know, the air, contaminated air and dust. To me, it makes very much sense. Let's fix our libraries, let's send our children to school, let's, you know, protect our women, and let's you know, provide good education, and let's, you know, let's grow more grains, and let's make the food and nutrients available to everybody, you know, and let there be no hunger and no poverty and no illiteracy. But no, somehow, issue of God in a negative manner is very important. You wonder why. It is all over the world. All over the world. Many of the people, terrorists, Boko Haram or these people. It's not that they have problem with women. They have problem with their religious belief that condemns women's education. So they are fighting for, you know, they are fighting against literacy of a particular group of people. And secondarily, if there is anything, you know, than anything else. Why is this obsession with God? Because we do not know God, and we do not want to know God. We want to know the God the way we have already known. We are interested in God, we are interested in our known God. And our known God is just exactly like us. Exactly like us. Never smaller than us, never bigger than us. Never darker than us, never brighter than us. Exactly like us. No? Now, how can we, even though I believe in that God, but really try to examine how can we really, really, really cultivate love for God who is just like us? If we are so good at hating ourselves, how can we not hate the God who is exactly like us? And yet we, you know, insist that we love God. So what we are loving is we are loving our own hatred. We are loving our own complex. We are loving our own ignorance. Yeah. That is why many great souls like Buddha, they said, let us forget God. In fact, I remember in 2001, January 26, 2001, in Kumbh Mela, and at least there are two, three, four, including myself, five, no, Madalsa, and Mary Gail, Dick, one, two, three, four, five, six, 7, 8, 9, 10. Yeah, 10 of us are sitting here. We were there that day when we were with His Holiness Dalai Lama. I was with him on the stage. And I gave my presentation. There were at least 30,000 people. And His Holiness, first myself, and then His Holiness Dalai Lama. Somebody asked a question. I understand Buddhism doesn't believe in God. So what is your opinion about God? You know what he did, Dalai Lama? He held person next to him on this side and this side. He raised his hand in the air. He said, you know, God exists or God does not exist. Leave it to us. You pay attention to, you learn how to be peaceful. See here, that is priority of Dalai Lama. He did not say he believes in God or he does not believe in God. He simply said, it came out from his mouth, you learn how to be happy, how to be peaceful. It means he knows his priority. And that priority is peace and happiness. Now, that's what he is. That's what he is made of. And his peaceful mind will look for a peaceful God. No? And if somebody's hateful mind will automatically is bound to look for a hateful God. This is what we have not understood. And see here how childish it is to believe that people, those who are born and lived before Moses, Jesus, Krishna, Buddha, they went to hell. Because you can go to heaven only if you believe in your Savior. And this Savior reached China, which is land of over a billion people. That's a Christian Savior, Jesus Christ, reached China. Somewhere in 18th century, before that, may have been, you know, some missionaries here and there, but it is only in 1840 or so, when finally the Europe dominated China after winning the Opium War, then Christianity was really put in place. Just to imagine, a God who enters your minds and hearts through the corridor of opium, what will be the quality of that God? God who comes to your home, or God who, whose promoters, helpers, come to your community and build the house of God at gunpoint. Just imagine what will be the quality of that God and the quality of those who worship that God. And yet, that's God. Krishna is God. That's what large number of people are saying. At least 700-800 million, maybe even billion throughout the world. Krishna was God. How many wars he fought, do you know that? Whole life, all he did, kept fighting, kept killing. And how much he was, how many people acknowledged that he was God as long as he was alive? I don't think that very many. Even his very best friend and most learned among all, Arjuna, he had his own doubt. And somehow, Krishna dispelled that doubt while Arjuna and Krishna and all these people stood in the battlefield. As Bhagavad Gita, that's how Bhagavad Gita was revealed or brought to us. Definitely there are a large number of people and very powerful people and very, very educated people, those who did not have any idea of Krishna as a God. He had a childhood, very rough childhood. Born in the prison. Somehow escaped the prison. Or his parents brought him out. Raised in totally different family. Was transferred from one house to another house, from one set of parents to another set of parents. He has all good reasons to be a very confused kid. You know? Somehow he grew up, and still his misery continued. Now, it's just the putting things in right history, right context, right historical context, and bringing out the right, let's say, or positive aspect of Krishna today makes us respectful about Krishna. Otherwise, there is no reason why Krishna to be respected as God or even incarnation of God or even prophet of God. And yet we have that God. Every culture has its gods. Every community has its gods. And yet those gods have not been able to do much to human race. Nor do we see much transformation in the lives of those who are staunch believers and worshippers of those gods. Did you ever wonder why? Is it something wrong with idea of God or God itself or our understanding of God or our interaction with God and our relationship with God? Where is something not so correct? Scriptures are there, and that's what, you know, I'm coming to the point. There are scriptures that tell us how to cultivate true love for God. Number one, understanding of God is that which creates true love for God. Why do you love and care for a particular individual in your life and you wish to extend your relationship with that person, where there is a spontaneous joy that comes from being able to be in the company of that person, learn something from that person, and your all resistance is demolished. You don't resist. Why there is so much resistance everywhere else? Because we do not have real understanding of the person or of the things. And this is what is needed even in order to cultivate our respect for and love for God. Number one, everything. God has to be something more valuable than any object in the world. How is it possible? How do we know that it is really true that God is more valuable than anything else? Okay. Whereas our cultural upbringing tells us that yes, $100 is more valuable than $10, $1 million is more valuable than $100, $1 billion is more valuable than $1 million. Being governor of the state of Pennsylvania is more prestigious than being the president of your local Lions Club. Okay? That's how we are taught. That's how we are raised. There is a different expectation of our elect politicians. And that expectation is much more bigger and more solid than the expectations we have from those who have been, during the elections, those who promote those politicians. Okay. This we see it in our daily life. What reason do we have to really love and care for God? And the reason so far we have discovered is very, very shallow and shaky. God is our Savior. What do we mean? He will save after we die. Wow! How many of us are interested in dying and finding God's protection after death? Why can't God save us while we are alive and help us not die? Where is our greatest attraction? Are we more attracted to being alive, or are we more attracted to be dead? Am I making sense? Our clinging to life and our fear of death or our dislike to death are almost in equal proportion. From both sides, you know, from both angles, what we really want is to live. We do everything to stay alive, and we do everything so that we don't die. How much role God plays in keeping us alive and helping us, you know, so that we succeed in not dying. If somehow we can find some evidence we love God, really then we love God. Perhaps then we'll want to have God our, have God not only as our guru, but rather God as our husband and wife and children and grandparents, grandmother, grandchildren, everything God. God inside us, God outside us, then we'll want to have God everywhere. So that in every respect, in every manner, we are fully intact. But we don't see it. How do we know that God is more valuable than money? And this thing is becoming, even this concept was, this kind of discussion was there even during the time, let's say, 3,000 years ago. Nahi vittena na samparayah prathibhati valam pramadyantam vitta mohena mudham. I am loko nasti para iti mani punah punaravasama padyate me. Kathopanishad. We are so convinced that there is safety in having a house, friend, spouse, money. In those days, banks did not exist, so you know, people's own home was bank, where they used to, you know, collect their gold coins. Cows, the more cows they, you know, in those days, like, you know, today we have, you know, the more diversified our assets, from mutual funds to treasury bonds to a high risk investment to real estate, etc., etc., in different currencies, and money preserved, kept in different banks in different countries. That's what we think, perhaps it's safest. If one thing goes wrong here, then at least something is, you know, still all right over there. And overall, it will turn out to be just fine. You know? That's how we have been living life. In the olden days, it was cows and gold and the silver coins and things like that. So, that's where people used to seek their protection. And that which guaranteed that protection was considered to be the most valuable thing in life. And there was continuously this feeling, this is it, this is it, this is it, let's live for it, live and die for it. This is more important than anything else. And this tendency has not changed in thousands of years. It is still the same. Still the same. How much people are engrossed in that. If God can be used as a force to protect that wealth, then it means God is a savior. God is something powerful. But still, it's not the end. It's not the goal. Having God as goal of your life is not something at the forefront of our mind. And whatever we think is at the forefront of mind, the amount of idea of God that is in the forefront of our mind, it's a cultural conditioning. We have been told again and again, and we are told to have God in our mind and heart. So we put aside a few hours per week. As a meditator in yogic tradition, we put aside few minutes per day or few hours per day. But the rest of the times, we are engaged into non-godly affairs. And we have good justification for it. And that justification is that we are human beings. As human beings, we cannot survive, cannot live without performing some actions. And furthermore, those actions are dedicated to, you know, God anyway. I surrendered, I'm performing my actions with a fully surrendered attitude. If that is the case, why are you frustrated in life then? You have frustration. You are not so happy. You are still seeing one work somewhat more meaningful than the other. It means the things which the work which you do not see very meaningful definitely is bereft of God. That's why you are not happy. Somehow there is more godly sense of more godliness in certain actions compared to other actions. That's why I want to do something meaningful. What is that meaningfulness? Well, something which really helps others. You are diffusing your focus. Called vyavicharani bhakti. It's an adulterated bhakti. You are diffusing yourself. All living beings and all human beings are manifestation of God, and therefore I want to do something which is helpful to others. Don't try to fool yourself. You are trying to see God's manifestation everywhere except yourself, in yourself. The point is here, we have a very diffused kind of understanding of God. And the truth is our value is something out there, or focused on something out there. This begins with a lack of understanding what life is all about. And here is how we overcome this problem. First step, realize that we have become experts, we have become masters of fooling ourselves. We have really mastered the art of self-fooling, self-deception. That's where our mastery is. We have intelligence. We are very intelligent people, but we use our intelligence to foster that self-deception. Those who are able to use that intelligence into, you know, manipulating others' consciousness in lawful manner, they are called smart businessmen. If you really look at, there are lots of businesses out there, and mostly the successful ones. They know how to tap into human sentiments. How to evoke human sentiments? Look at all the advertisement, all the ads, etc. Products that are there. We are so much in love with our senses and sensory pleasures, sensory cravings. And therefore, there are people, those who really understand this truth very, very well. They are called smart, intelligent business wizards. How to give attractive shape to your soap bar. How to choose the scent in it. How to put a wrapper around it. What should be the image on the soap wrap, you know, on the soap container. You know. And how to position it. Why? Because these things are essential to grabbing human attention. Is it illegal? No. Is it unethical? No. Then what is this? This is what, that's what it is, finished. We have right to promote our ideology and product, which is helpful to the human race. And such kind of soap is very, very helpful for the human race. Plastics, anything, just numberless products are out there. How to, and how do you market it? You market a product by capturing, by just capturing human emotions. That part we have done very, very well. Universities, colleges are designed for that. Gigantic colleges. And most expensive courses are so-called on business management related things. And that is where, look at the industry, how precise that industry has become. And how imprecise is still the industry of God, or the industry that leads us to God. Still, same old-fashioned temple and church, which has no practical application. Most impractical architectures are temples. So ill-designed in terms of sound travel that you speak one word and resounds everywhere. You want to be quiet and connect yourself with God, there is no place for it in a temple. The way it is designed. Imagine 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, somebody came up with that ill design, and still we are living with it because it is sacred architecture. Can you talk like this? No. If you say, if you do so, you will be prosecuted. You will be killed. You are criticizing sacred architecture. In any of such sacred architecture, in that case situation, many of our modern, you know, the religions who evolved later, Christianity, for example, much better in that respect. Churches are much more practical. There is a bathroom, you can wash your hand, you can sit in the church. There is a space, you know, you can, and there is a nicely designed and well-maintained, you know, altar where you can connect yourself with some sanctity. But in Indian, my God, it's like by the time you reach that place, you are just about to faint. You know, so crowded and not much air, no ventilation. No place even to walk around, inside or outside. But we held on to that. You know. So, there is no proper training or courses available in understanding God and formulating and creating a healthy ground for establishing a relationship between ourselves and God. Those courses are not available. If you come up with that course, let's say within the context of yoga, how more pathetic it could be that we teach yoga with a message that yoga will grant you freedom from fear, and yet we teach it with so much fear that if somebody finds out that there is a concept of a God in yoga, people might not like it, and therefore let's not talk about God. No? So see here, how can this yoga be effective in our life if we are learning it with fear? We are teaching it with fear. And this thing goes on everywhere. If there is a God, there is a God. Whether God is right God, wrong God, but it is part of yoga system. And we must practice truth while presenting God. And that truth forces us not to hide and not to lie. And yet,
We hide and we lie and we distort and we just make all kinds of sweet sounding statements, making sure that our product is not, you know, dismissed by others. Yoga is a product, God is a product, Yoga Sutra is a product, Bhakti Sutra is a product, you know, my courses are product. I'm selling those products, and product sale depends on people's, you know, acceptability and receptivity. See here, this goes on. Do you see a pathetic condition? In order to be a scholar, I just came back from a conference, you know, that was put together by a prestigious university that has full-fledged department of yoga and PhD programs in yoga, and Loyola Marymount University of California. And discussion is the political conditions or political impetus for Patanjali's proposition of God. What could have been the political reason for Patanjali to introduce God? Well, he could not avoid having God because people at that time were missing God because Buddha had condemned God. So people were in need of God, idea of God. And Yoga Sutra, by introducing God, Patanjali knew that his Yoga Sutra would be Yoga Sutra will have great appeal to the masses. And at the same time, their society was fragmented on religious lines. There was Krishna, and there was Shakti, there was Shiva, there was Brahma, there was Hanuman, there was Ganesh. And also, by that time, 300 years after Buddha passed away, even Buddha himself was treated as God. And therefore, if you promoted a particular God, name of God, then automatically you will not be so welcome by those who believed in God other than the God you just proposed. So very skillfully Patanjali made sure that he introduces God, however, without having a particular name and form or any personified identity. But in all probability, Patanjali could have been a worshipper of such and such God, which he very skillfully avoided not to tell anybody. And it's a very shrewd political move. See here. This is how we look at things. In order to be a seeker, you have to be politically, you know, savvy. As long as these tendencies persist, we have no hope or very little hope, very little or no hope at all. So how do we start? On one hand, there is enormous cultural and social pressure on us that forces us to think and conceive a reality which is totally contrary to God. There is a great force out there in the material objects, power, position, honor, insult. And yet we know that still all that power, all those powerful things have not yet been able to fill that empty space that is in all of us. So we are we are fully aware of that empty space. And we are not comfortable with that empty space. We are fully aware of the fact that there is quite a dark place inside us. It's very difficult, very painful to live with that darkness. And yet we do not want an unfamiliar fullness, unfamiliar light to enter that space and fill it with light. This is a dilemma most of us are faced with. And all the scriptures are telling us how to do the contemplation in order to cultivate true love for God, which is not God who just began to exist 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, but rather who definitely existed before the first human was ever born. How do we know that? Let's see here. We are very intelligent, evolved creatures. As long as we are healthy, strong, energetic, we think that we can accomplish anything we want. But there are occasions in life which really brings us to our very humble realization that we are really not that valiant and invincible as we think. Despite the fact that we are very blessed ones, very with 10 fingers and such highly evolved, you know, limbs, organs, nervous system, thought process, language, etc., etc. We are blessed. We have so much what our ancestors and our previous, you know, generations have left for us. We are recipient of such a great vast knowledge, pool of knowledge, libraries, universities, colleges, houses, so many things that we have today is not because we created them, but rather thousands of years of, you know, collective, you know, effort has gone into creating the world in which we are living today. And that's definitely a great, what you call, blessing. And yet, simple little things, tiny little mosquito bites you and you end up with malaria and it is life-threatening. God, how pathetic it is. We are so big, so intelligent. We have put so much time, energy and our intelligence into discovering the mysteries of life. And here comes a tiny little mosquito and he bites and we are sick. Done. How big are these Ebola virus? No? Oh my God. It's like, you know, and how powerful is the United States military, you know, forces? Very powerful. We can wipe out entire planet almost more than 1,000 times. No? United States alone, it decides, it can fly its aeroplane and demolish the entire face of the earth, including itself. You know, more than 1,000 times. And yet so much panic because there is a virus called Ebola, which we can't see through our own naked eyes. I was there when the first Ebola patient flew from Atlanta to Washington, D.C. And the place where I was staying was right at that particular gate. Through, you know, where the building where this patient was supposed to be there. When I came, and that day I had my lecture in Washington, D.C. It's Shanti's home. Her home is right at this National Institute of Health. We drove in and we were quite curious all over. Camera, news media, you know, different channels. They were very friendly. They told us what's happening, what's going on. And we saw helicopters and just literally completely stable in one place in the air. 8 hours, 10 hours, that camp, you know, that helicopter is waiting for Ebola patient. Finally, that person comes, lands at the airport, then transported into helicopter, and then all other helicopters, media helicopters, they are around it, they are moving. It was just a scene. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. When you pay attention to that, say, my God. How really strong are we? How invincible are we? Are we really that invincible? And this way you can just continue looking at yourself. You are a great master, great yogi. You have done your practice and you left your prana, and through that nadi called Susumna, and you enter your great state of, you know, Sahasrara Chakra, and there you are united with your Shiva. You are doing it every day. Okay. One day, something just happens, and what happens? That your potassium or sodium balance, sodium goes out of balance. You are such an intelligent person. You can teach mathematics to the entire planet. Sodium out of balance, and you are looking at your clock. The you know, your 12 looks like, you know, 11, your 1 looks like 11, 11 looks like 10, and the whole clock seems to be going other way around. It's 2 o'clock, but you think it's 10 o'clock. And you are shouting at your wife and children that why you have, you know, you are hanging the clock other way around. What's wrong with this machine? Okay. You forget your entire mathematics. One stroke, your entire knowledge and wisdom, and not only that, now you are no longer able to... or inhaling and trying to figure out which way to inhale, through your nose or through your ears. Then you, wow, what happened to my yoga? And what's the point for this whole yoga stuff? And if everything really goes well, everything goes perfectly well, then you come to final stage. Then it means you are 80, 90, 100 years old, and you have already gone through the process of aging, and it was very graceful. Everybody, you know, you still had, you know, kept eating your birthday cakes on your 99th birthday and 100th birthday, and everybody thought that you are the perfect example of great health. But one day, you know, you got slapped by force of dying, death. Your inhalation and exhalation are confused. In the middle of inhaling, you are trying to inhale, but it turns out that you are exhaling. Your entire breath training is so fantastic. At last moment, it's not working out. The whole lifetime's experiences are put in one lump, and comes the summary statement. And summary statement is, I hate this world, I've lived here, no good is coming to me. You are not even able to think properly what you are worried about, what you are fearful about, what you are complaining about. And with that discomfort upon you, get. As long as you are alive, at least there was hope. that you will call for help and somebody will have come to your aid. As long as you are alive, there was a system whereby you could confess your sins. Now how are you going to confess your sins? You no longer have body, no longer have senses, no longer have mind, no longer have sense organs. You have no conscious awareness even to ask God to and pray for some help. You are just dead. So well dead that even along with your death, even time is dead. Space is dead. And this whole idea of linear thought process is dead. Entire law of cause and effect is dead. You are just dead. Think of that. You are just dead. As a dead person, you have no ability even to do any prayer. If the prayer is what really helps God, if prayer is that what inspires God to help you, then you are doomed. Really doomed, because you are not able to do any prayer anymore. The question is here, are you going to come back after death or not? If you are not going to come back, then why do we care for anything in life when we are alive? Then that is where this materialistic philosophy comes in handy. Eat, drink, and be merry, and there is nothing like ethical, non-ethical, as long as, you know, you are able to live your wild life, just do it. There is no life after death anyway, so why not to enjoy everything possible while you are alive? But somehow, deep inside us, this logic does not, you know, really holds very well. We do want to know something about our life. There is something tells us there is some law and order, not everything just accidental. There is something very natural, biologically we are designed to love and care for others. We are not that, you know, there may be a mixture of forces, you know, functioning in us where there is love and hatred and greed and selflessness, everything together. But we are not absolutely greedy people either, selfish people either. There is love, there is compassion, and there is a desire to see others benefiting from your hard work. Okay? Why is that? And every, you know, how many people do you think must have been crazy, those who said, or must have been, you know, fake and hypocrites or liars, those who said, you know, as you sow, so shall you reap. No? These were, quote, a different kind of logic is coming in. That there are pros and cons. There are statements, there are logics, reasons that can be presented from both sides, right side and left side. But there is one logic that comes from every direction. I exist, and I have desire to exist. I feel my existence, and there is an amazing sense in all of us, every living, not only human beings, even non-human beings have a strong desire to see their continuation and blossom and do everything in order to blossom before they die. From plant life to mineral life to amoeba to bacteria to virus, you know, to animals, reptiles, and humans, non-humans, everybody. The inherent desire for us to thrive is something self-evident. Now it is that life has fallen prey to death. And it has fallen prey to death so intensely that there is nothing left to do anything about it. How do we come back? How do we get back to that sense of self-identity, self-existence, and begin to feel the continuation of life? This is what is called contemplation. Before we really strike our head and shatter into pieces, it's better just to simplify our thought process and just reflect on this principle or fact I'm just going to, about to state. And that is, there is a reality that remains ever alive and awake, even when we as certain individuals or all of us as individuals have fallen prey to death. That reality is Sarva Bhava Adhishthatrittvam, Yoga Sutra chapter 4, Sutra 25. That is Sada Gyatashchitta Vritteha. No? All of our thoughts, feelings, sentiments, emotions are good, bad, right, wrong, all subtle samskaras. Everything is fully known to one reality. That reality is ever awake, all pervading. That reality is selfless, not attached to a particular individual, not attached to a particular color, caste, creed, church, temple, or mosque, not attached to even a particular planet, star, or a galaxy, but rather absolutely untouched by everything and everyone, and it has full concern, loving concern for everyone and everything. Sarvatha avish, sarva vishayam and sarvatha avishayam. Sutra 54 of chapter 3. Sarva vishayam, everything is inside it, known to it, and at the same time, it's totally untouched by what it knows. Okay? That reality is there, fully aware of our all likes and dislikes, our fulfilled and unfulfilled desires. What is fully aware of, what is good and auspicious for us, what we must achieve in order to find fulfillment and freedom. That reality is there. And it is the gentle, loving, you know, generous, kind touch of that reality brings us back to life. It is that sheer, it is through its sheer intention that again, you know, that reality awakens us. We become aware of our existence. It's very delightful to see that reality standing right before us. We suddenly get courage, despite that we have gone through so much pain, so much sorrow, so much struggle, so much, you know, difficulties. We worked so hard and gained so many things, and we lost absolutely uselessly. Just everything we lost, just hardly, you know, few hours ago, few months ago, few years ago, you know, God knows how long we are sitting in that state of deathlessness, you know, in that state of death, you know, we have no idea. Because time is also dead. Really, after death, whether we are there in that state for a, from our standpoint, for a microsecond or for trillions of years, they both are equal. 1 second and 1 trillion, 1 second and 1 trillion years are exactly alike, because it's state of timelessness. Because with our death, in relation to us, our time is also dead. And it is in that timeless state of death, spaceless state of death, we are just sitting, we are just asleep. And it is from there, you know, here, intelligence is granted to us. Or let's say the same very intelligence that has become dormant is brought to life. It's very delightful that nothing is lost. Very delightful that our creator, our preserver, our provider, our protector has always been there with us. And with that thrill, that joy, with that enthusiasm, we return. And that is how our journey begins. And then again, whatever is the best for our bhoga and apavarga, for our freedom and fulfillment, exactly that kind of body, that kind of samskaras, again awaken. And our journey toward life, to lifeward journey begins again. Just to look at this fact, and then start looking, and just start getting into little bit deeper details. That what is happening there when we are in mother's wombs? How are we getting the nutrients? Who is that? What is that guiding force that making sure that only certain type of our DNAs, you know, and genetic qualities and characteristics of our parents are awakened, and the rest are put there in our storage space? No. There is an intelligence that is deciding everything. And this way we continue growing. There is intelligence, amazing intelligence. We talk about, you know, going to Africa, and therefore before go to Africa have yellow fever, you know, to call shot. You know, how inoculated we are when we are being born. Everything is right there in that birth canal. You know. By the time baby is out and, you know, touches the air, outside air, that baby is no longer the same very baby that was inside the mother's womb. And so many things that which were so completely foreign to the baby have become an integral part of the baby. And therefore, there is an amazing phenomena out there that makes sure that an armor, an astra, a kavach, an armor, a vest, is provided right at the instance, right at that moment of birth, so that you are able to defend yourself. No? Okay. If you keep looking at life, from the time of conception all the way to your birth and to your early childhood, then definitely, unless you have decided and unless you are determined to condemn the reality, this higher reality, you will be able to see that there is a reality, and that reality is with you, that reality is all around you, that reality is in you. And that reality is probably you, right there, an integral part of you. The more you know it, the greater the love and respect and confidence you have in its protecting and guiding and nurturing force. And if you do not have that, if it is just because somebody else has said, and just because you are afraid of, just because you are told that be fearful, otherwise you will be condemned, then definitely you cannot love it completely. Your love is bound to be incomplete. Your love is bound to be conditional. And definitely you will be forced either to live with a great deal of discomfort and frustration, and you are bound to practice dishonesty with yourself while holding on to that God and reality, and otherwise you are bound to keep shopping and keep switching from one church to another church, from one group to another group. Any person out there, I was taught, although in those days I did not understand what it meant, but the more I'm reading these books and more I'm interacting, more I'm realizing how wonderful was that teaching when I was taught, when I was told that anybody who says that I believe in such and such guru, you can conclude that this person does not believe in anyone. Finished. I follow such and such person. It means this person does not follow anyone because he has not known, this person has not known anything about oneself and the force that is to be followed in life. How can you follow anyone when you do not know what is that truth that must be followed, and without following it, you are nobody? The truth, the thing is, that truth you follow or you do not follow, that truth is following you all the time. If it is truth, eternal truth, your ideal, your eternal companion, Then regardless whether you believe in that truth, regardless whether you follow that truth believes in you, that's plenty. That truth follows you, that's plenty. That truth believes in you, that's why you exist. That truth follows you, that's why you exist. We exist. That means there is much higher truth that is constantly accompanying you and following you. And it is in response to that truth's belief in you that you are to some degree confident about your thought, speech and action. Contemplation on this truth is that's what will help you cultivate true love, you know, for true devotion for the higher reality. So let us stop here. Then we'll pick it up from there hereafter. Good.